Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks so much for your company. Joining us today is Eddie Enova, a naturopath and somatic-based psychotherapist who has recovered from cancer 3 times. And today we'll be discussing his journey and how he now helps others to benefit from what he learned. Welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast. Eddie, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Mate, it's again. So we're going to do the blooper right at the beginning, and that is, everyone, I forgot to press record. So Eddie and I have been talking already for, what, a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and we have to start right back at the beginning. So welcome back, Eddie. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Again. Yeah. So to start off our journey, we're going to keep saying again, but to start off our podcast, tell us a little bit about your first diagnosis and your journey.
Yeah. So it takes us back to 2013. That's when I was diagnosed. It was 10 days before Christmas. But before I tell you about that, the preceding 6 years, so I got gifted a business, a 10-year-old existing health center. I had about 10, 12 practitioners already working for this the center. I had a yoga hall, and I'd been given it by an absolute angel in my life who wanted to pass that on. And I was very young in my career. I was very green in my naturopathy career. I'd only been qualified a few years. And this opportunity came, and I was young, 33 in the prime of my life, had a 2.5-year-old son and a pregnant wife, and I'd be given this opportunity to set the family up. That's the way that I saw it. So absolutely all head in. And I quickly realized that I didn't know anything about business at all, but I did know how to work very hard. And so when things didn't work well, I worked even harder and rinse and repeat, doing that over and over again over about a 6-year period. Things weren't going well. I wasn't feeling overly well within myself, a lot of stress, and I was internalizing a lot of that stress. And then the diagnosis came, like I said, 10 days before Christmas 2013, and in an instant, life came crumbling down. And that sent me on my journey with cancer over the next couple of years, trying to get myself well. I had 3 relapses in those 2 years. I went from stage 1 to stage 4. I had a 9 cm by 8 cm by 3 cm tumor in my abdomen, a couple of tumors in my chest, a couple under my collarbone, one in my neck, and one in my lung. So I was pretty greedy. I had a lot of cancer within me. At that stage, it was chemotherapy resistant. It wasn't responding to the drugs. And my oncologist was literally scratching his head going, "We don't know what." And so it took me on a big journey into getting myself well, understanding not only what was wrong with me, but why it was wrong with me, and making some big changes to my life, and also finding some integrative approaches to essentially sensitize my cancer to get me cancer free. So there's a lot there.
Right. So like you said, something very interesting there about sensitizing your cancer. Mm. And we discussed this while we weren't recording, but take us back to that initial diagnosis, or even prior to that. How did you find that there was an issue? In our last conversation, again, unrecorded, you said that you weren't listening to whispers of your body. Tell us about these whispers. What was happening?
So what I've learned a lot from cancer, and we'll get to that, is, these signs and symptoms that we all complain about, and we try to take our vitamins and minerals and medicines and try to medicate to make them go away so we can get on with our lives. These are the whispers I'm talking about. This is the feedback mechanism that our body gives us to get our attention to make changes in our life. That's what I wasn't listening to, because I was so in my head was stress, in my chaos, and you know what was going on within my life and my young marriage, and you know trying to manage you know the business and it not doing as well as that it could do, but me not having the skill set. You know, I was so wrapped up in that I couldn't hear through the noise, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then eventually, obviously, in the shower, I felt my right testicle and went, oh dear, that's not good. And luckily enough, I have a friend who's a GP who could very quickly see me and get the ball rolling. So very quickly got diagnosed after that point. That's what I meant by the whispers.
Right. And so from initial diagnosis to treatment and then progressive treatment where the news isn't good, take us through that journey. What was going through your mind? I mean, it must have been hell because you were diagnosed 10 days before Christmas, a usual celebratory time in Australia where we meet with family, have holidays, have 1, 2, 5, 10 drinks.
Yeah.
You've got a different thing going on in your brain.
Yeah, it was a tough year, that one.
Mm.
It was a tough Christmas, you know, especially because realistically nothing happened. I did have surgery before Christmas. 3 days before Christmas I was in surgery.
Oh,
so Christmas I was recovering from a surgery. But again, life came crashing down in a moment. You know, I was 33 in my prime, you know, 2.5-year-old son, pregnant wife, business, and, you know, new home that we'd moved into and, you know, expecting a child. You know, everything was the prime, you know. And then all of a sudden, the C word, you know, and like I mentioned when we talked just before, the C word is so much wrapped up in it. So much fear in that little word, cancer, and for everyone involved, because you know when you're diagnosed, it's not just you that get diagnosed; the whole family does.
Mm.
Your wife does, your husband does, your mum does, your sisters do. They all go on a cancer journey, and it's not necessarily with the physicality of the disease, but it's everything else that's wrapped up around that. And so, it was a tough Christmas for sure.
Hell yeah! So that. Like I'm still coming to terms with what you must have been feeling. Mm. I can only try ineptly to imagine the wall that must have been just in front of you, this holy crap, this is real moment. And
it
you've
was,
got
but
these
like
responsibilities.
I said, it was very short. It was very short lived though, that wall. Like like I said before, like it was there and everything came crumbling down and, you know, very, very hard to swallow that, oh my God, you know, it's me. But I very, very quickly switched into, okay, what do we do? Let's rock and roll with this, whatever it takes. You know, when you've got a young family and you've got a 2.5-year-old looking at you and a big bellied wife, you know, with a baby in there, whatever it takes, bring it. And so I had to switch into that mode. And now I would be absolutely lying if I said that I could keep that through 2 years of treatment. There were absolute lows. There were some very, very low, especially each time when you're told that it's coming back or that it's back, pretty hard to swallow again. But I think a big strength of mine is to be able to, to forge forward, whether that's I'm a Taurian, whether you're into astrology or not, but I'm a Taurus. So it's just like stubborn, just right, yeah. Head down, go for it, you know, charge. But, show me where I need to charge to and I'll charge.
That's indeed positivity. Positivity isn't putting your head in the sand. Positivity is taking bad news and going, okay, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Whichever direction you can. But I need to ask you about and I don't like this word because it has religious connotations, but faith. Mm. Your faith in yourself, in your own acumen of what you'd learned in naturopathy and indeed your faith in natural medicine.
Yep.
Did that ever waver, like when you had your second, third diagnoses?
No, interestingly. So when I was first diagnosed, at the time I was really deep in the personal development world and soaking up all the different teachers that were around. And there was a guy, and I think I'd seen him on Remember the Old Secret. Remember that when that went around? There was a guy on there that sort of sparked my attention and I sort of went down his wormhole. It was Dr. John F. DeMartini. Mm. And he's sort of like a human behavioral specialist. And he's got this little process where it just gets you to flip things on its head and have a look at, all right, so here's your challenge in your life. Where are the benefits? Okay. So he talks about counting your blessings there. So I went through a bit of a process over a couple of days where I thought, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to count my blessings. So I've got cancer. How is this going to be the best thing in my life? How am I going to benefit physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, spiritually, financially, you know, within my relationships and my family? How is this a blessing in disguise? Where is that silver lining? And so I went over and I started writing this down, and I still got the diary. I carried around with me quite often, and like in consults, I'll show people to say, hey, this is what I did. They may want to maybe have a play with it. And so over a 2-day period, I came up with over 800 different benefits. And that was a really key thing for me. It was just to help shift my mindset towards it and start to go, all right, here are the benefits, right? Let's rock and roll with this thing. Rather than, because you could very easily go into a victim mentality and go, oh, woe is me, and oh, no, all this is happening and that. But I didn't want to do that, you know, and I think it was just where my mindset, what I was exploring at the time. So I went deep into that and found these hidden blessings, and they were like a bit of an anchor for me for the emotional roller coaster that the cancer journey absolutely is. I could keep coming back to where are the benefits. And for me, you know, that just changed my mindset, my relationship to what was going on.
I'm very impressed with your mindset, Eddie, because you're very much like Lise Altshuler in your positivity. And that is, I'll always remember Lise, who's one of my favorite people on this earth. Hi, Lise. And she said, when she was questioning a patient who was afraid to die, and she said, well, isn't that because you love life so much? Mm. And there was this, the same issue, different ways of looking at it.
Totally different ways to relate to it.
Yeah. And so is that what, have you always been like that, or did you have to learn that?
Well, that was a PhD in it, you know. I had to learn very quickly, but listen, yeah, it's really helped me, and it continues to help me, obviously, like in the way that I practice now, helping to help others find some meaning and purpose within their diagnosis.
Yep.
Rather than potentially, oh, you know, I've been burdened with this, and it can absolutely crumble, and I see it all the time. But, you know, I like to help people on, dare I use the dirty H word, the healing journey. You know, cancer patients don't only need the curative path or the curative journey when they're trying to medicate the lumps and the bumps, but, you know, we have to remember that there's a human attached to the lumps and the bumps, and that human has an experience of their disease process. And that's a little bit more of a deeper journey, maybe philosophical, maybe spiritual, if you want to use those words, into what does this mean in the context of my life? And so I really enjoy with my therapy type work that I do, and that's the reason why I do the therapy work with what I do, is to help people change their relationship to the disease, to find potentially some meaning and purpose, which can help motivate them to, you know, address this next few years, because let's face it, a cancer journey is not just a couple of months, it's years. Yeah. You know, for me, I was diagnosed in 2013, and if I'm being super honest here, it's probably only in the last 3 years, 4 years maybe, that I feel like I'm back on top of my life.
Right.
With a good 7 year coming to journey. A halt. Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know, everything comes to a halt. So my marriage unfortunately broke down during that cancer journey. The stress of the whole journey was too much, and it broke. It showed the cracks that were already there, and we were a young family with a lot of stress. Mm. Plus you put a cancer diagnosis on top of that. It didn't have the strength, the infrastructure to hold that. And so unfortunately that, so, you know, a marriage broke down, my ability to wake up next to my kids every morning. So here I am now, a single father. Yeah, a career has to come to almost a standstill when you're under treatment. Like you can't consult, you can't work when you're on a heavy treatment. Like my treatment, because testicular cancer is very, very heavily treated. What that looks like is 3 chemotherapies on a Monday and then 2 every other day of the week for 6 days straight. So 7 days of intensive, aggressive chemotherapy and then 2 weeks off. You're not working, honestly, like that amount of cytotoxic poison in the system, you're barely functional. And so when you're a business owner, like I was, career comes to a standstill. And so when the momentum comes out of your business, it takes a long time to rebuild that up. And plus your own trust in your body, trust in your own health. Is it solid? When's the next relapse coming? You know, I've had 3 already. Why isn't there going to be a 4th? So there's all these things that need to be, well, I had to work through coming out the end of that cancer journey. And that's taken many, many years.
I have to also take that emotional aspect that, let's leave it at emotional. I'm trying to think, the esoteric isn't the right word, but anyway, existential aspect. And I always take that back to biochemistry. We know, for instance, that emotional stress releases noradrenaline, which will propagate or, you know, lead to a higher risk of bony metastases. Mm-hmm. So we know that these stressors, emotional that they are, have a biochemical impact which affects your cancer cells and then therefore your cancer journey. So turning that on its head, and you will retard any growth driver, if you like, or some of the major ones at least. That's the emotional side. The other one, as you said, was the time off work. And it's something I'd like to just ask you quickly about, the money aspect, because a lot of people out there, they have, you know, TPD insurance. We're speaking Australia here. Other countries have their own issues. I get it. Let's say we have total and permanent disability insurance in Australia. You might have income protection, which allows you to get 75-odd% depending on the provider of your income. What happens there? Because they only give you a lump sum for the first diagnosis. It doesn't see you any further, and they sure as hell won't insure you later.
And it's also like getting blood out of a stone as well. Like, it's not a quick process.
Right.
And quite often when you need it, it's not when you get the money.
Gotcha.
Comes down, you know, a lot. And I didn't have any income protection. Again, we were a young family. We're, you know, in that money-making stage of life, or not even in that stage, gearing up towards that. So we didn't have a lot behind us, and the financial strain was massive. I lost everything. We ended up having to sell that business. We sold our home. You know, obviously, you know, the stress of it all did eventually, you know, break up the marriage. And we didn't have a lot. Once you go through a financial separation, there wasn't a lot left over. And in particular for me, I think I walked out the back end of that with something like $6,000. And, you know, there's other things that happen, which, you know, that didn't last very long whatsoever. And there were moments when I was literally lining up at churches for emergency food support with my young child, my youngest, who was born then down the track, in my arms, getting moldy food to, you know, to help. And the Salvos and Vinnie's, St. Vincent's, were just the most amazing support. So these are things that sometimes aren't talked about, is the aftermath that can be caused from all this, depending on how much support that person's got and their own, obviously, personal circumstances.
Yeah. You know, we've spoken, you can speak all day about the effects of stress and how that affects not just the dynamics and relationships, but also physicality. But what about things like light bulb moments that you might have had about not so much what you were doing, but how you were doing it?
Yeah, that's
Is there any of those that you can share?
Huge one. You know, obviously, you know, I was following doctor's orders, you know, for testicular cancer, which has very, very high success rate of cure, absolute cure with first line treatment in the realms of 94-98% success. Here I am, relapse after relapse, going from stage one to stage four. It was at that third relapse where I sort of had to take a step back and kind of like, what the hell am I missing here? You know, I'm doing what's prescribed to me. I'm supporting it with my beautiful, you know, naturopathy and all the skill sets that I have, yet it's not happening. It doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. And that was one of the biggest light bulb moments. And it was more like a fry pan to the head than a light bulb moment. And it was, I'd missed the point. I was focusing on what was wrong with me, not why it was wrong with me. And so I was trying to get well within an environment that was not conducive to getting well. And that's a really important thing that I talk a lot to my clients about, is, let's do a life audit here. Is the environment conducive to the outcome that you seek? And for me, it wasn't. And so I was trying to get well within this chaotic environment, and the chemistry of that stress, the cortisol, the noradrenaline, the inflammatory cytokines that we know all help sort of propagate and make beautiful, rich environment for tumors to grow and spread within. All the environment was there, perfect for it. And that's what I was not addressing, and it became that light bulb moment where I went, oh, I'm missing the point here. It's the way that I'm trying to do this isn't correct. So that's when I had to make some very large changes to, first of all, myself and my own internal environment, how I manage my emotions and manage my stress. And then obviously the broader environment of, oh, this business, this isn't working, is it, at all? The stress of the financial stress, right? We need to sell a home. We need to make things a lot easier and get that allostatic load, that total stress load out of my body and out of our lives as much as possible to give me a better chance of success here. So that was a almighty light bulb moment for me. I think we're so used to going into the pharmacy and getting the over-counter drug, you know, that takes your headache away, and it works. Yet when it's the chronic complex conditions, we don't have these magic pills, unfortunately. And so we still are searching for that. And rather than looking at the power of some of these changes, like you say, can we move more? Can we breathe better? Can we sleep better? Can we eat better? You know, can we stress better? These are like the basics of health that have a huge return on investment when we dial them in. But you know, humans aren't good at change. We're not good at behavioral change. You know, it's much easier if there's a bottle of pills that makes it go away, but the unfortunate truth is not. And so a big part of what I do with most people is trying to inspire them to make change, because that's where health comes from, but it's not an easy one.
You mentioned something about headaches there, and in our, again, unrecorded conversation, you mentioned that, you know, these bad symptoms or these bad things that happen to us. I'm putting a label on that word, on that, aren't I, that bad. But, you know, when cancer happens to us, when pain happens to us, it's actually your body giving you feedback to say, listen, dude, there's something wrong. So about that, with regards to, you know, cancer, can you put it down to something that you were doing wrong to get the disease? Do we go that far?
Listen, we've got to tread very gently around this, because it's very easy to start to blame ourselves for something that we've done, potentially. Yeah. And it's not about pointing blame. I don't think there's any benefit in doing that. And I know a lot of people around, and even sort of like practitioners that are in the oncology world, don't like to, you know, to talk around these things, because it is a touchy subject that can, you don't want a patient to believe that they've brought this upon themselves. No. You know, it's such a multi-causal condition, like all the chronic complex conditions. You know, I quite often describe it a little bit like a mosaic. You know, you've got that mosaic made up of individual tiles that make this one big picture, and we've got this disease picture. What are these partial causes? And if, you know, if we can look at it from more of an empowering point of view, what are these partial causes? How can we address each one of these? You know, I think it can, you know, mitigate potentially that victim mentality or a patient thinking that way. So for me personally, there were a lot of pieces of tiles in that mosaic. You know, if I reflect back, you know, I was born in New Zealand. I was born in kiwi fruit country. Most of my childhood was playing in kiwi fruit orchards, which are sprayed to buggery with God knows what. Our little town in the Bay of Islands there had the highest rate of lymphoma of the whole country. Is it related to, you know, the sprays? Apparently not, the ag department says. But, you know, has that played a part in it? Probably. Before I was a naturopath, I was working in the printing industry. A lot of inks, a lot of solvents, volatile solvents like acetones and acetates that I would be bathed in most days. Is that, you know, a partial cause? Probably. You know, the stress levels that I wasn't dealing very well with, you know, through that, those 6 years of business, and my skill set around emotional and self-regulation, emotional regulation, were not good. Is that a partial cause? For sure. There's so many, you know, I could look at a trauma background, you know, and my inability to listen to these whispers, which is what, you know, trauma and our backgrounds can do. It can just disconnect us from our body, so we don't hear the whispers. That's all interlaid. Now, I can't point to one thing and go, that was it. I think it's that whole thing that comes together as a constellation, that perfect storm, so to speak, that can, on the right day, with the right injury to a cell, is the perfect, you know, ingredients for the soup that is cancer.
Yeah. And that's a very important message about stop blaming yourself if you have cancer. There's nothing you can do about what's happened. No. As your beautiful, positive mind takes something and says, that's what is, that's a fact. Let's move forward. Let's use this and move forward to change it and see what we can do about it. That's something I really admire about you, I've got to say.
Absolutely. You know, and the thing is, we can't cure the condition with the same conditions that created it. So let's create a 2.0 version of ourselves and move forward. Can we actually learn from this? Is there wisdom in this process that my body's going through that I can maybe start to learn from? And let's do things differently. Let's eat better. Let's, you know, relate to people better. Let's manage our emotions better. And let's, you know, social life, let's improve that. You know, all this sort of things. You know, it's, I think if we can create an environment within our lives and our bodies that's hostile to cancer progression, then, you know, we're on the right track.
Let's talk a little bit about strategies for therapy, though. And I don't want to sort of paint a prescriptive view at all, because, you know, everybody's different. But, you know, when we're talking about bang for buck therapies versus, you know, for instance, false hope, say, or those things that are going to give you the best opportunity, the best chance of sensitizing your cancer to orthodox treatment, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, for instance, what sort of things do you find of most use?
Yeah, I think, and I can't remember if we talked about this in our first interview.
We didn't.
Today or not. But, you know, there are the strength and limitations of complementary alternative medicine. And I think, you know, where complementary alternative medicine really thrives is to be able to support that individual patient, the strength of the body, the strength of the immune system. We are fantastic at being able to sensitize cancer cells to treatment, but we're not so good at killing cancer. We don't have these cytotoxic medicines that are very good at killing cancer, unfortunately. But modern medicine does. So how can we then combine the two to get the best synergy possible? And I think, you know, from a CAM perspective, from a metabolic point of view, trying to interfere with that cancer as much as possible. So looking at some of the hallmarks that drive cancer growth, inflammation is a huge one. So can we help to squash inflammation as much as possible from the body with our beautiful omega-3s, or might be SPMs, or our curcumins, boswellia extracts, all these anti-inflammatories, herbal or nutrients that can help to do that. Now that's an important thing. Now we have certain compounds that do work on a metabolic level with cancer, and these are things like, you know, some of the quercetins, apigenins. You know, we've got resveratrol. I'm not being prescriptive here at all, because, like you said, everybody's cancer is different, and some things aren't appropriate, like resveratrol and breast cancer, sometimes not the ideal thing to do with certain sorts of breast cancer. But the point I'm trying to make is there's lots of different compounds that can absolutely help to metabolically weaken the cancer. So I'm a big fan of like a press pulse strategy, a sensitizing phase and like a kill phase, and how we can link that in with modern oncology, which typically is cyclical in nature for the most part. You know, you might be having chemotherapy once a fortnight or once every 3 weeks or something like that. Very different depending on the cancer. But, you know, if we have a framework that we can work in, what can we do before chemotherapy to set the scene up to get better efficacy of treatment? So what can we use to sensitize it? This can be nutrients and certain herbs that are appropriate. It can be exercise, breathing techniques, things like oxygen therapies, hyperbaric oxygen, maybe hypothermia, which is something that honestly saved my life, hyperthermia, heat treatment. You know, what blend can we do that's one achievable for a patient logistically and financially, because some of these things do add up, and that work within the oncology framework.
What about things like exercise?
Absolutely. You know, I think most oncologists now are more confident to say exercise is a good thing for cancer patients. Yay. You know, they are getting more and more comfortable with that because there's so much research around it now.
Yeah.
The way that, you know, our big muscle groups, when we do work them out, they produce these chemicals called myokines, which act as a tumor suppressor. So like I always say to people, you've got free medicine locked up in your body. Why not use it? Drip feed yourself every day with, you know, smart exercise that obviously isn't too full on for someone who's maybe in a weakened state on chemotherapy. They can exercise for them is different to someone who's not on chemotherapy, but move the big muscle groups, get this chemistry working for you.
So do you advocate any specific types of exercise? Like, for instance, you know, I glibly in my earlier times said sweat on the way there and sweat on the way out to your therapy. But obviously, you've got to put that into a context of how that body can cope Totally. With that exercise. Totally. Yeah.
Listen, for some people, exercise is walking to the letterbox and back. And that's a struggle for them. And if they can do that and then start to get comfortable with that, then maybe I'll tell them, go up the street to the first light pole and back, you know, and start to build like that for someone who's, let's just say, they've been the 2 years into the cancer journey, they've had multiple relapses, they're riddled with side effects, chemotherapy, neuropathies, nerve damage. Mm-hmm. You can't expect them to bust it out on a treadmill or start lifting weights. It's unrealistic. So it's meeting that person where they're at, anything that extends them a bit above beyond, you know, what's comfortable for them without creating, you know, risk for them. But for someone who's maybe got a little bit more vitality and they haven't undergone any treatments yet, you know, maybe something like high intensity interval training, you know, a smarter way to work out where we're doing short bursts of maximum effort with a huge recovery time that's not so taxing on the body, that that hormetic stress of that type of exercise can be really helpful and really healthy as well. And obviously for cancer outcomes can support that. But it is highly variant on that individual and where they are in their journey.
Forgive me, everybody. I am jumping around a bit because there's things that I wrote down here unrecorded, which I need to bring up because they're so important. Talking about stress versus your genetic and environment, you know, when we're talking about prioritizing or stratifying what effect stress has versus the genetics versus the environment, where would you place each? What emphasis do you place on helping somebody to change, let's say, each of those areas?
Yeah, well, I think obviously things that impact the body directly are probably a priority, like especially when they're in an active treatment. So diet and lifestyle become a bit of a priority because it's something that is chemistry. It all produces chemistry within your body, either directly or indirectly. So, you know, a dietary supplemental medicine regime, getting that all dialed in. Stress is a big one, but you know that often comes down to the way that we perceive our world, and that's the way that we are, our infrastructure, and where that's developed from. So that's a little bit of a deeper journey for people to understand themselves and why they stress the way that they stress. So that's a little bit more of a medium term journey for them. You know, you obviously straight off the front back and get people regulating their nervous system better with breathing techniques and maybe a bit of meditation or an app or something like that. But ultimately you want, or what I want for that person is them to understand why they do what they do. And you know, they, with that knowledge, they can start to actually change the way they interface with stress. And so things that may stress them out before doesn't need to stress them out anymore if they can change their relationship to it. So that's a deeper journey that's not really a priority straight off the bat. The genetics and how that sort of, you know, interplays with this, I think, you know, especially with the stress, it's such a powerful epigenetic trigger. You know, we have these genes, we may or may not have these genes, which are sensitivities. It's just, do we express those sensitivities or do we press the button on these? And ideally, if we can make people aware of what these big epigenetic triggers are, let's not press those buttons, hey? Let's, you know, so if it's poor diet or if it's lack of exercise or high stress levels or any of the other ones, you know, let's put the odds in our favor here. And if we can raise the awareness of what these are, then at least these people have options. Do I press the button or not?
There's Sorry. You go. Forgive me.
I was just going to say, just to round that out, the environment, which is sort of interlaced with the whole thing, the environment you're getting well within, the chemistry of your life, which is really what epigenetics is, isn't it? You know, the chemistry of your life is the epigenetic triggers. That's the thing that presses the button on our genes, is how are we interfacing with our life? Can we clean up certain aspects of that? If there are big red flags, what do we need to change? What support do we need to bring in? So we've got less buttons to press. That's always ideal. But again, these, when you're in the thick of treatment and you're on chemotherapy, this stuff's really hard to fathom. You know, when you're fatigued, when you're emotional, you might be riddled with side effects and ulcers in your mouth and vomiting. You know, that's hard to swallow. But again, for me, cancer is the disease, not necessarily just of the flesh and bones. It's also a disease of the greater life. And so as part of that broader healing journey, which is, what does this mean in the context of your life? We've got time, you know, if we're supporting these people really well and they are getting successful outcomes, we can deal with that stuff down the track a little bit, medium term solution.
Back to your journey a little bit, and I guess this is for other people as well. You know, you had your first diagnosis, second, third. How were you managing yourself in in between, were you doing any tests or any other assessment that can reduce this hypervigilance that is a chronic issue for cancer thrivers, cancer survivors? It's, how do you attack that? How do you, I'm using the wrong words, how do you address hypervigilance? And do you look at biochemical
anxiety, cancer anxiety? Is that what you're
cancer anxiety, the recurrent anxiety, but also trying to assuage that with things like, you know, looking at certain tumor markers or circulating tumor cells, circulating stem cells, things like this?
I think when you're in the thick of the journey, that's sometimes not actually even necessary to be looking at that stuff. And all those markers from a blood point of view, what, you know, oncologists and medicos can do, they'll be doing that anyway if the, the type of cancer produces something to monitor. There's a growing trend with oncologists not to really monitor markers, which are, you know, blood markers, which are very easily done. A GP can do it as well. But there's a growing trend that, you know, you just get your diagnosis, you get your treatment plan, you go through it, we'll scan you at the end, which is all well and good for Mr. or Mrs. Doctor there, but unfortunately for little old patient, we need something to hang on to. We need to know, is this pain and suffering worth it, and is it working essentially? Is these treatments actually working? So some sort of evidence can be useful. How much though is a little bit of a double-edged sword. You know, the dose makes the medicine or the poison sort of thing. Yeah. You know, too much controlling of the environment, too much controlling of your blood test can maybe create a bit more anxiety, you know, just the right dose to Goldilocks zone, just to give them enough to go, right, no, keep going. This is that we're on the right track. So during the treatment, typically you don't need as much because we know what the issue is, the treatment involved. And yes, let's check in maybe on a monthly basis, but we're not looking at under a microscope every single week or anything like that. Certainly after the fact, if you do get that no evidence of disease and now you're in remission, anxiety can be incredibly strong for patients, incredibly strong. And I know this intimately, you know, every lump and a bump that comes up, it might be, you know, a very innocent lymph node that goes up under your armpit or in your neck because, you know, the kids have brought something home into the house and they're sick, but your mind automatically goes to, oh shit, here we go again, because your body remembers, you know, how it felt that day where you got the C word thrown at you and all the somatic reaction to that, that's still alive within you. And so having to monitor that, that's where, you know, having a healthy dose of control around your circumstances is good. And I like the word control because that can have some negative connotations, but empowerment around, you know, your journey. So am I semi-regularly meeting with a practitioner, you know, a GP, a naturopath? I'm working on my health. I am doing certain tests periodically just to make sure I am well and I'm tracking in the right direction. And that's where maybe the circulating tumor cell, circulating stem cell counts may come in as a really important part of that, to know I'm on the front foot here. I'm not just taking the doctor's word at face value and everything's fine. And then my next appointment is 3 months later. It's a long time between drinks, between tests, you know, for a lot of people, there's a lot of suffering inside of that. And listen, some people just want to get on with their life. They don't want to do tests. They just want to forget about it and get on with things. And I sort of get that. But unfortunately, the evidence with cancer is that if you do that, you may be up for some more suffering down the track, because, you know, the reality is most people are going to get a relapse or unsuccessful result. And the sooner that we can pick that up and get on the front foot with it, the better for the outcome, the longer term outcome.
Well, herein is an issue of that word when it's given to the patient of cure by the oncologist. You are, you know, you have achieved a cure. You are cancer free. Tell us about what this really means, cure versus, you know, the expectation long term, and I guess this ties into
oncologists are pretty hesitant to use the C word, to be honest. They don't use the word cured often, because the reality is they can't deliver on that a lot of the time. So they use other words like disease free survival time, which is, you know, how much time before the next relapse, essentially. And so every cancer patient wants to hear the C word, though. They want the cure, and they want to chase the curing journey. But typically they won't get those words.
Yeah, but we still have touted around these 5-year survival times, which to me, it really rankles with me, because, okay, 5 years and one day, oh, then that's fine. 5-6 years. But whereas
that's not cure though, is it?
That's just five. No, that's years right. Of life. So yeah. So should we be really looking at a minimum of a 10-year survival time on all cancers, not just one type of breast cancer? You know?
Well, listen, they do have 10-year survival stats as well. It's just they don't like to bring them up because they're quite deflating for Mr. and Mrs. Patient, yeah. To hear such a low single digit statistics isn't nice. But also on the flip side of that, it's important for people to understand what they're really dealing with, because maybe then they will step things up in their life. Or if they hear like 80% get thrown at them and they don't know what that 80% actually means, does that mean 5-year survival or 10-year survival? Mm. What is it? But they hear it through their ears of, I've got an 80% chance, 8 out of 10 chance of getting this. Oh, I don't really need to, you know, change my diet or change my lifestyle or even look any deeper into this. My oncologist has my back.
Yeah.
No, that's not helpful in my opinion. It's just, how can we fully inform that person to go, right, this is what the reality is. Are you happy with that? If you are, fine. But if you're not happy with it, what can we do to start create your own statistics? Because those stats, they are the 60 to 70% of people that fall underneath the bell curve, yeah? The expected outcome. Now, do you want to be the expected outcome? Is that good enough for you? Or do you want to become an outlier? Because these things, these medicines that we've talked about today that are locked up in our body, the way we breathe and the way we move and the way we eat and the way we think and stress and our mindset, these are all powerful prognostic factors that shift us to the right of the bell curve, to that extraordinary outcome, which we want to be the one that, you know, the oncologist is scratching his head going, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it.
Yeah,
we want to be that person, yeah?
The thing that annoys me there is they don't want to know. Keep doing it, but I don't want to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I don't get why they don't want to know. They're doing science. These are doctors of science. And so science, that scientific method needs to be measurable and repeatable, and the whole scientific method and variables create noise, and we don't want variables. And these things like the way we move and eat and breathe and stress, these are powerful variables and powerful prognostic factors that are hard to measure, very hard to measure. And they get in the way of science and stats. And so, but for me, I care more about a patient surviving than the stats. I always say, don't be average Joe. Don't fall under that bell curve. Be non-average Joe. Create your own statistics here. But that's going to, you know, be an extraordinary effort on your part. Are you up for it?
This is obviously the difference between population medicine and personalized medicine. And again, this word personalized medicine it's starting to be used in mainstream medicine now. I don't think they're doing that. It's kind of like how they say preventative medicine. It's really early detection.
Yeah.
Preventative medicine, like, come on, there's this whole aspect of truly prevention, personalized medicine.
Yeah.
There's this whole aspect of truly personalizing medicine, like, for instance, looking at certain tumor markers, you know, how you're going after your therapy, not just having a scan, but looking at other assessments. So let's go into that a bit.
Just to bounce off you there, it's so important. Like, I think medicine's very good at treating lumps and bumps in the body. Or they try their best to treat the lumps and bumps, but they forget that there's a human being attached to the lumps and the bumps, and that human being is going through a cancer experience. And you know, there's a Hebrew sage, I'll probably murder his name, I think it's Maimonides, and he said it's more important to know what sort of patient has the disease and what disease the patient has. And I think this is where medicine is not personalized. It doesn't understand the person that's sitting behind that desk there who's got the diagnosis, but they're great at the biology of the lump and the bump.
Yeah.
And yes, we absolutely need to treat the lumps and the bumps, but we also need to support that person. And that's these two journeys that I allude to that a cancer patient needs. They need the curative path, which is treating the biology. And then they need the healing journey, which is, what does this mean in the context of your life? How are you doing with this whole thing being met with your mortality? How's that shaking things up for you? What can we learn from this? What does this mean in the context of your life?
Talking about, you know, orthodox medicine versus complementary alternative medicine, whatever you want to call it. I'd prefer to call it functional, but there was some research and it was very interesting how they, you know, talk about divide and conquer. It was very interesting how they set up the research to say those people who did orthodox therapy versus those people who denied or reneged on orthodox therapy and only did complementary alternative therapy to the omission of orthodox therapy. And of course, the complementary alternative therapy people fared worse. But at no stage did they think of doing a third arm about what if we added orthodox therapy and added some supportive measures in there. And indeed, we've now got an oncology center, and I've just gone blank on her name. Forgive me. She's going to shoot me with the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse in Sydney. And she's an incredible woman. And she's written this whole sort of white paper, if you like, and it's been accepted and it's now gaining momentum. But there is still this denial of that supportive measures can be useful in helping patients to get a better outcome from their chemotherapy, radiotherapy.
Wholeheartedly agree.
Nothing to say on that.
Nothing to add to that. It's absolutely, it can, when done well. You know, there are ways to do it really badly. And I see this all the time. People come in and they're being prescribed a list of things, and some of them are contraindicated. You know, they are interfering with the mechanism of action of certain drugs or interventions. Absolutely. So I understand, you know, there can be some hesitancy if oncologists are seeing people coming in doing these types of approaches, the shotgun approach, you know, just throw stuff at it. You know, say it's a chemotherapy that relies on producing oxidative stress for its kill mechanism, and then the people are juicing and taking antioxidants, which is sort of counterproductive. It's sort of interfering with that oxidative nature of the drug. Yes, efficacy is now compromised, or it might be a herbal compound that speeds up clearance of a drug that they're using. And so it's not hanging around as long as possible, getting as much return on investment. That's decreasing efficacy. That's not a good thing. Or maybe it slows down the excretion of the drug, which means we're reaching higher concentrations, which might be more toxic, so more side effects. Now, that's not ideal as well. But when we do it from an evidence point of view, and we look at the evidence that we have for these compounds with these drugs, and there's an abundance of research there that we can draw from, there are ways to do it well that doesn't compromise outcomes, that actually adds to outcomes.
All right. Well, I've got to ask here then, we need to find out more. You've got a course, right? Is that correct?
I've got a program. Yeah, I've got a program. Great. It's all video-based program. People can sort of work through and learn all about this stuff and all the levels that we've sort of touched upon.
Is this patient-directed or practitioner-directed?
No, this is patient-directed. Yeah.
Patient-directed. Okay. So can we just please give a call out first. So your website where patients can find out more?
Yeah. So it's just www.eddieenever.com, E-N-E-V-E-R. That's basically all the stuff that I've got going on there. I think I've provided to you a link for the program. People can go have a look and see what's involved, and there's a bit of a discount, you know, if they use your link, which is fantastic. I want people to access this. It just helps to paint the big picture. It helps to empower them with the knowledge that they need to be able to become that outlier, you know, to shift their statistics in their favor. And it's all these things that aren't just about taking lots of supplements and medicines. It's this free medicine that's already locked away in your body. It's just, how can we liberate it into the body and get some benefit that's waiting to be used?
Well said. And I dare say this course isn't just for patients, but indeed for practitioners, because at some stage they're going to be dealing with this, whether it be personally or, you know, within their family or close ones.
I go pretty deep. If you haven't noticed, if someone who's had the journey that I have had, you know, it's made me appreciate the condition in such a deeper way. And I think for best treatment, we need to look at all these levels of what it is to be a cancer patient.
Yeah. Eddie, you and I have discussed this prior to today, and that was about, at some stage, we all will reach the end of our life. Mm. And with some people, that's going to be from their cancer. Mm. Take us through how you approach this from a functional medicine perspective, because I think sometimes we think, oh, therefore we've failed. Our medicine has failed. And it's not, because orthodox medicine fails. At some stage, people will die. How do you address this with patients about what their expectancy is? Do you approach this right at the beginning? How do we talk about this topic?
It's a big one, hey. It's a big one for people to consider because they've been met with their mortality, and maybe this is for the first time. I'm seeing an influx of young women coming in with breast cancer at the moment in their 20s, late 20s, stage 4, 26, 28, crazy. Like the prime of their life. Some of them haven't even had kids yet, or some of them have got very young kids, and it's very hard for them to even imagine that, oh, is this end game for me? So again, it's not necessarily how long we live. Sometimes it's how well we live within that lifespan. And there's so much that we do that we can do by changing the way that we interface with our life that can extend that. But the reality is we are all going to end up in the grave. We're all online, aren't we? It's just how quick do we get there?
Yeah.
And so for me, I had to develop a different relationship to life and death. Again, it gives you a PhD in this because, you know, you're met with it. And everybody has a different relationship to it depending on what they've experienced. Yeah. Some people may have had a lot of death in their life before that. And maybe they're more comfortable with it, or maybe it's the total opposite as well. Maybe it is absolutely petrifying. And so supporting that person with psychological help through that is absolutely crucial because, again, if you are absolutely so fearful of life, you are so stressed, what is that doing to the prognosis? Now, if that is, you know, a prognostic factor, like a powerful progressing factor because of that stress chemistry that gets released because you are stressing every single day. This is my last day. He told me 6 months, that the oncologist, you know, pointed the bone at me and said, I've only got 6 months to live. And you're watching that calendar. I can guarantee it. One more day down, you know, one more week down. So, you know, that's not helpful. You know, can we reframe people's attitudes towards their life, to their healing journey, and also empower them to understand that, you know, just because someone's been given, that you've been given a, you know, a prognosis here, 2 years, 6 months, 6 days, that's not your statistics. Can you create your own statistics? Can you become the outlier, the extraordinary outcome that gets that oncologist scratching his head? You know, and then what does it take to achieve that? That's what I love doing because now you start to give that person a reason to live, you know, something to get up each day and start to attend to their body and their mind and add to their prognosis, not take away.
Just a last question, and that is about compliance long-term. You know, as you were, I think you alluded to earlier, you know, people, they might go in all gung-ho and then after a little bit the normal laziness sort of creeps back in, the old habits, the old ways. Yeah. How do you keep people on track so that they get the very best out of your treatment?
It's awareness for me. All of it comes down to that person's awareness around how this works because, you know, life will come back in and it will get busy and, you know, our self-care routines and all those beautiful habits at some point will sort of flail a little bit and then other things will get injected in. And it's really educating that person on what health creation and cultivation looks like. And yes, we are going to go off track, but if we can recognize that and then pull ourselves back in, you know, so we go out, we go in, just can we hear the whispers? You know, so reframing people's attitudes to what health actually is, you know, what signs and symptoms are, and can we start to relate to ourselves and to health in a different way? So we can almost self-audit and then pull ourselves back online and we go out, come back in, go back out, come back in. Now, I think that's crucial, the way that I tend to approach it with patients.
Eddie, thank you so much for taking us through both your journey, but also how you help others along their journey with a cancer diagnosis. And you're like, you're an impressive man, I've got to say. Like, not the least of which is your voice. It's beguiling, sir. But I can't thank you enough for your openness, your candor about things that are really taxing and really, you know, they really put us on the spot with our mortality. And you treat it with this real love and honor of life. You've done so well. Well done to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about this stuff. It needs to be talked about.
My absolute pleasure. And thank you for your company, obviously. Remember, we'll put any research papers that Eddie mentioned, we'll put up, obviously, Eddie's course and anything else of interest up there on naturalmedicinepartners.com.au and certainly in the show notes of this podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you soon. I'm Andrew Whitfield-Cook. Bye for now.